"Your cavalier," said the Lady of Night quietly, "drew on my cavalier." As Gideon died gently of shock, buoyed back to life only by the weird bruises forming at the top of her spine, the other girl broke out into miserable coughs. "Oh, I'm so sorry," she said. "He's just overprotective. He never would have meant, oh my god, you're Black Vestals. Oh my god, you're the ninth calf." The girl in Gideon's lap covered her face and seemed to break into sobs, but it became apparent that they were gurgles of mirth. "You've done it now, Pro," she gasped. "They could demand satisfaction. You'd end up in a mausoleum centerpiece. Lady or Lord of the Ninth, please accept my heartfelt apologies. He was hasty, and I was a fool." "Come on," said Gideon. "You fainted." "I do that."
You're listening to Nunpod with Left Grief, Episode 7, A Beautiful Corpse. They have made the trip from the ninth to the first house, and we don't really know how long that took, but it doesn't seem like they've been in space a super long time.
I think it says an hour, actually.
Oh, does it?
I believe an hour of space travel is mentioned.
Oh, goodness, that's fast. I was thinking of you as I was rereading, because the descriptions of the first house as they're seeing them are so kind of choked with that sensory language that I know you really love, that I was as I was reading, I was imagining you reading.
And you know, it made me actually think more about Gerber than anything else.
Yeah.
And how, like we have this extraordinary bright planet, but what we have is someone experiencing something incredibly novel.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Gideon has, and Harrow too, have no context in which to fit this visual besides this overwhelming difference. And this opening scene, I'm listening to the audiobook and going back through it this time, and just the way that Moira Quirk like changes tone in the final line of that descripting paragraph of like from like this generic like visual sentence to like Gideon's explicit inner monologue, like this is the way that this has been summed up in Gideon's head. Hot damn, what a corpse. Grimy versus these, and it's fun because we kind of start in with this brightly polished language, and then it's like, but it's like real gross and decaying.
It's like kind of both and both. It's like it's lousy with water.
Lousy with water.
Which is such a weird phrase. And it's smudged with the chains of like islands or floating cities or whatever we're seeing. Smudge the blue with gray, which it gives this like, this sort of polluted aspect.
And it also kind of like, I don't know how, like you're thinking of a descriptive language that Gideon would have access to. Like sprinkled is not a thing on the ninth. Like it might sprinkle some bone dust, but like sprinkling of islands, sprinkling of clouds, these things don't exist in Gideon's visual language.
Yeah, but smudge she knows.
Yeah, smudge she knows, for sure.
You know, most people interpret the first as earth, and it's so cool how Muir really frames this in a way that makes it feel really foreign. It doesn't feel like they're coming into the familiar to us. It feels overwhelming. It feels strange, even though, you know, we are used to a very blue planet and a blue sky.
yeah, totally. And like the language is such that it would be believable if this was an artificial atmosphere, but it doesn't explicitly say that it's an artificial atmosphere. It just uses the same kinds of phrasing to describe Gideon's observation of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it does not explicitly, like Gideon has no reason to confirm that this is jetted in through some other infrastructure.
We also get kind of a clue about Jod's situation here, because it says in the first paragraph that the Lord of the House of the First and the Lord Undying has not come back in 9,000 years, not 10,000. Yeah. So this tells us that he hung out on Earth, according to the common history, for 1,000 years before he left and never came back.
And we don't at this point understand why he left and never came back.
Right.
But there is the impression that he can't come back. I think that is contained in the text.
Yes. So that kind of gives us a sense of how long he was at Canaan House, or maybe how long between, you know, the glimpses that we see in Harrow the Ninth and him leaving, that Canaan House would have been built up and used, and kind of the periodization of some of the clues that we encounter later in this book.
Yeah. Yeah. If you out there have a recommendation for a really cool timeline that someone might have been putting together regarding those clues, that would be really cool. And we'd love to share that kind of work.
I've heard of one.
Because, like, this fandom is fantastic in terms of its archival tendencies and scholarly tendencies. And yeah, like we've talked about the artwork, we've talked about cosplay and that kind of thing. But like, I think another thing really worth acknowledging is I see it as academic, but that's not really it. It's like the skills that come out of writing and organizing written knowledge and written story. Like, this isn't exclusive to academia, but like there's a set of tools, archival tools and organizational tools.
Yeah, there's a lot of research in the fandom.
Tons. And like, it's not hard to find a hyper specific theory or someone going into this, because it's really well articulated. It's made super accessible generally.
While we're here a little bit meta, I want to remind anybody listening to this point, you know, we've talked around some spoilers in previous chapters. We are going to really spoil some stuff in this chapter. So if you're not prepared for big spoilers, be aware of that.
Speaking of spoilers, what we get here are characters that we get in the second book. We don't really know that at this point, but these are characters we develop quite a deeper understanding of than any other ones, really.
Yeah, and I think that Tamsin Muir, as we've discussed, really, really loves to lay out these little breadcrumbs that won't mean anything until you already know. But in this chapter, we really get some, you know, anime main character size clues.
Yes. Yeah. I think my favorite first one is Harrow going, "It's a grave."
Mm-hmm. Which totally makes sense, because the Ninth is a planet that didn't have, you know, a natural evolutionary process. There haven't been billions of people probably who have lived on the Ninth in its history. And there have been billions and billions of people who have lived and died on Earth. And so the Thanergy signature of Earth for someone who lives on the house must be so overwhelming.
I would wonder, though, to counter that, is that the Thallergy signature in this would also be really fucking weird.
Oh, yeah. So,
because we're looking at
just all the impression, plant life and stuff.
Like, plant life and super absent, I get the impression of, you know, an extensive people population. Because, like, she certainly isn't clocking much off of teacher.
We get implied fish, though.
We get implied fish. So there's ecosystem. So this asks the question, how...
Confirmed fish? I think there's fish. Sorry.
Do fish give off different allergy vibes than a poison? We will never live it down if we don't talk about the sunglasses. We have to talk about the sunglasses. This is such a fucking, like there needs to be... Please, someone animate this. Like, Gideon putting on the sunglasses and, like some big guitar lick in the background. Like, the moment these... Please, someone, make my dreams come true. When you think of these glasses,
mm-hmm.
are we looking at, like, thin black frames, big mirrored lenses, and then we've got our distinctive aviator shape? Do you have any theories about, like, where these came from?
I have heard that this is a Homestuck reference, but I don't know Homestuck at all. Can you explain the reference to me?
Okay, so Homestuck's out there. I am but a baby Homestuck. I only know so much, so please gently elaborate if I miss things here. The most distinctive character immediately that stands out with these sunglasses is Dave, who is just like the cool dude. But Dave is also a little in denial of reality in this way that I could see Gideon's...
Originally given the name Insufferable Prick.
Yeah, he's obnoxious, but he's also but a child. He thinks extremely well of himself, and it makes him sort of hard to predict sometimes.
Interesting.
I have spent some time trying to get deeper into this world. I have never found a Homestuck podcast that has finished the whole series. If you know one, share one with me. But I did find some really cool voice acted, like that was actually fairly extensive through it, but they go through the whole comic and actually have voice actors. It's a YouTube series and do quite a bit. So if you want to get into Homestuck, that's a really nice way to get into it.
It's such a big media.
Yeah, it's so big. And like I got was into Homestuck back when it was like, because I wasn't on forums, I didn't realize that fandom existed. It was just like, here's this weird comic that someone showed me once. And it's to this day, Andrew Hussey, the creator behind it, is just like got a really weird sense of humor and a really weird sense of art and narrative. It's the kind of thing that absolutely needs to be revisited to really wrap your head around it because of all the moving parts. So it does definitely appeal to the same type of crazy nerd. I would be curious about like the behavior of the Homestuck fandom in comparison to the behavior of the Locked Tomb fandom. That might be an interesting conversation if anyone feels like they have thoughts to contribute on that topic. I would love to open a conversation on that. Because the Homestuck fandom was, it's almost a bit legendary for kind of like it being a bit unhinged for its time.
Yeah, it seems to me like Homestuck, the sort of stock response to Homestuck being mentioned to a person who likes Homestuck is somewhat similar to someone doing a pun, where like the correct response is sort of revulsion and horror.
My version of why I make that response, and I can't speak for behalf of others, because I do think a piece of it is that this has become a codified way we communicate within the fandom, is this like, it is painful to be a fan of this media and this creator. For me, it is painful because the body of work is overwhelming and it's designed to be convoluted in its storytelling because it's like all connected, but like told in different mediums. And it's an enormous body of work. It's like trying to chase something that like it's always out of reach. Like, it's very, very enjoyable and satisfying as you start getting into it and you're like, there's all these cool details that are getting more elaborate and like this cool visual. And the art style is also really fun and really unique. But like, it pains me that like, I can never fully take all that in. And I think the expectation to have fully done every detail is a little overwhelming.
We also get embroidery mentioned for the first time.
Ancient embroidery.
Ancient embroidery.
Oh, do you mean the embroidery from the ninth robes or the embroidery on teachers?
I was thinking of the ninth robes being embroidered.
Yeah, I think that is mentioned first, but not long after it mentions teacher's belt, which has, I think, one of my favorite descriptions in the book entirely. I have a bit of a love interest with Byzantine jewelry and a general love of archaeological jewelry and the stories that come with them. But all of that aside, like the richness of color that this implies to me, like something that is so old yet causes such an impression, means you have an incredibly fast pigment. And if we're looking at like material examples of things that stand up to 9,000 question mark, does it say 1,000 years ago? I feel like it does say specifically
9,000. That, well, we Jod left 9,000 years ago. We don't.
Oh, his belt. They looked as though. Okay, it looked as though they'd been made 1,000 years ago and kept in loving perfection. So we're looking at certain materials that are very colored fast. We're looking at, this is probably ceremonial. They're receiving the lictors and cavaliers in a ceremony that hasn't happened in 10,000 years, essentially. So like, this is wildly has been set aside waiting for this.
I kind of don't imagine that the priests have a life outside this. So I sort of assumed that they and their clothing have been sitting in the dark for 9,000 years.
Yeah. And the description of teacher fits that. Like, he's described like a bit of a doll.
With teacher, as well as with Gideon, there's some sort of ambivalence about status. We don't see it at first, but he, you know, is a construct. He has been created to serve and presumably to have this cheerful, servile personality. But at the same time, he's given this elevated title that is explicitly symbolic. Like, he is sort of in place of God to them. He's saying, you know, you can call me teacher, and hopefully you can someday call him teacher. And so he is in this viceroyship for God while being also in this, you know, inherently kind of degraded, recycled state.
But he does assert his authority in this like really interesting, soft little way where when they're talking about like inconsistencies, mm-hmm. Where is the beautiful line? Harrow is commenting on the fact that the third has brought an additional person, and they're kind of discussing the implications of this. And teacher implicitly says, you know, isn't it ridiculous that you think to question this, essentially?
Like, yeah,
negative could come from what I approve of.
Harrow Hark says twins are an ill omen, and teacher seemed tickled. How delightful to hear someone say an ill omen could come from the mouth of the emperor.
This is how teacher asserts authority.
Is teacher the mouth of the emperor?
I think...
No, like, the third house is the mouth of the emperor. That's one of the names for the third house.
Oh, thank you. That's its own interesting implication.
Yeah, like, what's so special about the third? Why could an ill omen not come from there?
And like, does that mean that they're also a house of like propaganda?
Oh, the mouth of the emperor.
The mouth of the emperor. So this isn't teacher asserting his authority. This is him reasserting the ways that we are supposed to view the different houses. We are not supposed to see that the third house could offer ill omen. It is the mouth of the emperor. It's reasserting the hierarchy.
Yeah, the imperial order. Interesting. So we have two shuttles that haven't landed, the third and the seventh. And teacher indicates to Harrow that there are discrepancies with these shuttles. But I love that teacher is just sitting here sort of gossiping with Harrow. Like, he doesn't actually have to tell her this.
That's true.
He kind of says they need clarification. There's an inconsistency in both. And Harrow Hark repeats the word inconsistency, like she's just kind of thinking about it. And he just kind of he's like, oh yeah, you know, the third will push the boundaries. You know that they're gonna push the boundaries. So like, we learn something about the reputation of the house, which it's so interesting with your suggestion that this is like a propaganda outlet, that they're also boundary pushers. So maybe the propaganda is oriented to be a little bit scandalous, or, you know, that's kind of part of the deal, which feels a little bit kind of Hunger Games-y, like how the capital is.
And the fact that there's like, you know, like skin mags, mm-hmm. as part of that propaganda machine is a little bit scandalous. That's absolutely fitting in with this. We can paint a picture of what is like this idealized lifestyle that I imagine the third tries to represent.
And, you know, Iante is sort of performatively horny and boundary pushing throughout.
Yeah, she's the worst.
Teacher starts to comment on the seventh, and then they start landing, and so he gets interrupted, and so we don't get to have the clue. We get this beautiful, distinct description of Iante and Coronabeth, where Gideon notices that her brain automatically made Corona Beth taller because it just didn't make sense that they were the same height.
Yeah.
And she perceives Corona as tall and statuesque with a star white grin and masses of bright gold curls. And Ianthe seems small and insubstantial with a sheet of hair the anemic color of canned butter, which tells us some stuff about butter.
The anemic color of canned butter is such a great phrase.
And an equally bloodless smirk. I love the idea. It was as though the second girl was the starved shadow of the first, which kind of like gives us this clue about this wasting element of necromancy, which of course we don't know yet that only Ianthe is the necromancer. But it almost suggests like, how could they have not gotten caught? Because Corona is so healthy.
Because like throughout so many descriptions we have of the two of them, like I still jump on that train. Like I imagine Corona Beth has bigger shoulders. Like they're like, for me, it was always that they were paternal twins and they're just different as two twins can be different.
I assumed that they were identical because even identical twins can have different gene
expressions, right?
Because sure. Different things can shape gene expression. And so I had imagined that they would have been identical if they were both necromantic. And the depth of their difference is the difference of necromancy.
So to make sure I understand you, they are identical. And because Corona is not doing necromancy, she is full of vitality. And Ianthe is doing all the necromancy, and thus she is wasting away.
That's how I read it.
Okay, because I always read it as Corona Beth is not capable of necromancy.
Oh, I agree.
Oh, and so that's my underlying argument for, like, you're saying it could be variants in gene expression. I'm saying it might come down to a bigger difference in genetics. We are still both arguing that it is genetic in nature.
Genetic-ish, I think, for me. Genetic-ish. Like, I'm not committed to the idea of genetics. Obviously, environment seems to play an important role because where you give birth seems to matter, not just kind of who you are. I kind of think about it as like an epigenetic thing, like an epigenetic and environmental thing, where it's sort of a genetic injury more than a genetic mutation. Teacher comments to another priest about the third house having three people.
Mm-hmm.
Only trouble at the end of the line, and a trouble confined to them.
The fact that this has only happened once before, but teacher is like so clear on what is about to go down, mm-hmm. that something that is already breaking precedent is like no big deal.
He's not even fussed.
He's not. And so that means that either what is set ahead of them is very quite structured, he can kind of predict how this might go, or like there were iterations before this that he has the knowledge of, like prior to the first set of lictors, like as they were trying to figure out how to do this, how much
they made him as part of their process, I think.
But that doesn't mean that he wouldn't have access to that knowledge, I don't think.
No, that's true. We don't know what he knows.
Yeah, we don't know what he knows. And so is it that he knows the history of the development of lictors so he can anticipate and spontaneously like reason that it's not going to be an issue for him?
Speaking of what teacher knows, he looks at Kithareia and he says, "You should not have come." And she says, "But isn't it beautiful that I did?"
Yeah.
It seems like he has to know who she is because she hasn't disguised her body. She has, like, she just is the person that she is. It seems like he has to recognize her and is just like, oh, that's weird.
Boots on the ground. She outranks him.
I think so.
And I'm pretty sure he's bound to not broach the confidentiality of the God Emperor's strategies. Like, he can't out her. And conveniently, what we know of Kithraea's health, like the questions that he asks her are entirely sincere.
Also, he sort of does some of the talking around, kind of not answering. Harrowhark says, you know, was the Lady Septimus diagnosed with this this blood flaw?
Yeah.
And he doesn't say she, that woman that we're looking at. He says Dulcinea Septimus was not meant to live to 25, which is true.
And the only claim that it currently makes about Dulcinea Septimus can be interpreted very liberally.
So it seems like the inconsistency on the third shuttle is there were three living people trying to land, which is too many. And the inconsistency on the seventh is there were not enough living people trying to land.
There were not enough living people trying to land.
So they know that Protesilaus is dead. They know, it seems like they have to recognize Kitherea.
Yeah,
and so they're just like
they were scanning them all up in space.
And he knows on site that Gideon is not the correct cavalier. Like they know exactly who they're looking for. Kitherea has fainted into the arms of an unprepared priest, and Gideon bolts over from where her shuttle has landed to where Kitherea's shuttle has landed and has swept her up in her arms and is navigating this moment of being threatened by Protesilaus, and then Protesilaus in turn being threatened by Hera.
Kitherea's Dulcinea being just like repeatedly like overwhelmed with delight.
Completely delighted by this. Treating this as if it is hilarious and delightful and theatrical, this opportunity to be in trouble with the Ninth absolutely delights her.
Stand down, you goof. You're going to get us in trouble. Like, this is like a game for her from the very beginning. And thinking about the way that Muir writes, where it's like everything means more than one thing, like I listen to the things that Kitherea says as Dulcinea in these scenes, and I'm like, I wonder how much was the act and how much is her just like saying what she means. And like, it's kind of fun going scene by scene and being like, okay, what does she actually mean? What does she want to be understood? Because this is her first impression, and when she realizes the relationship that she's building, what is Kithrea's motivation at this moment? This is the beginning of this final mission of hers. She has been working, like, this is an opportunity that she's been waiting for a long time to fuck over John.
Mm-hmm. It seems like her mission is to obviously pass off Pro as being alive and pass off herself as being completely frivolous and non-threatening.
Mm-hmm.
So her language is really girlish. She's kind of silly. And then, of course, is really exaggerating her very real illness as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you remember if it talks more about why? Like, I mean, it was convenient that Dulcinea also was very ill. But does she talk specifically about why it's the seventh, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Why the seventh is who she chose to, like, impersonate.
I think it was because she and Dulcinea looked a little bit alike.
Okay, easy enough. Talking about Gideon's reaction, it specifically says this running thing where, like, it says earlier in the book that Gideon never ran unless she had to. Gideon ran now because this is the first pretty girl that Gideon has literally ever seen outside of a magazine.
The second pretty girl, because she was literally rubbernecking on the previous page about Corona Beth.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
So,
second pretty girl.
She has seen two pretty girls in one day, a thing she has never experienced in her whole life.
And she is processing. So now she's processed that pretty girls exist. And now there's one that's falling. And she has to do something about it right now.
I have to assume that the shuttles landed in order, and so I can only imagine what this looked like to the eighth, who were in between these two shuttle bays.
Yeah, yeah.
As Gideon is just bolting. How far this must have been. What a silly thing that she's done.
Yeah, and like this is described to be like quite an expansive space. Like I'm imagining like this echoey sound of boots running to like, you know, what was maybe a quiet murmur between pairs of individuals, now just completely silent and just boots, and like for everybody else, time would slow down as the Ninth Cavalier just starts sprinting across the room.
It's so hard to reread the description of Protesilaus having had the reveal that he is being puppeted. It feels so obvious. It feels like, how did I ever read this description and think that this person was an alive, regular guy?
I think too possibly, you know, this performance that Cytherea is doing is to draw attention away from Proselaus being looked at ex like she's making such a spectacle of all of the different elements that she once noticed about herself.
Well, and I think it's also it's such a diversionary tactic that Mira uses with her writing, where there's so much kind of stylistic exaggeration that when you see something that seems really out of place, you just go immediately to like, this is an exaggeration, this is stylistic, and then it turns out half of it's literal. So you read he was a 6 foot collection of sinews. He was uncomfortably buff. He had upsetting biceps. He didn't look healthy. He looked like a collection of lemons in a sack. He was waxen looking in the sunlight. Like reading this, knowing that he's dead, you're like, oh yeah, he sounds like a golem. But reading it originally, you're like, ah, he sounds like a gym guy.
He sounds like a gym guy. And some of this language was used in describing Harrow's parents,
We've
describing this.
already fallen for this trick once, and we're just so willing to fall
You're like,
for it
haha,
again.
we need another puppet for you. This one's extra spooky. Don't take off the ribbon around its neck.
Mira could pull this trick on me any number of times, and I'd fall for it again.
She probably will again.
Yeah. I'm curious about what the blood flaw is and how it works. If this is it, like, as a eugenics scholar, I'm wondering if blood flaw is a eugenics thing or if it is literally a blood disorder. And it could be both. For sure, like eugenicists have been interested in things like sickle cell anemia, which is both a blood disorder and genetic. But I'm very curious about the construct of blood flaw and what, in fact,
Because it feels very euphemistic.
it does.
But
Is explicitly understood as heritable. So seems like this is a genetic condition.
and this is a would be a great example of one of those things where you read what Muir's written and you're like, this is metaphorical, or like a flourish of description, and you're like, no, it's sickle cell anemia.
It could be sickle cell anemia if they have adequate medical treatment because it's a recessive blood disorder. And so most of the carriers don't have sickle cell disease. But if you have sickle cell disease, it's fatal in childhood unless you have adequate treatment for it.
It'd be an interesting one to carry because, in terms of this theory, this as something that affects necromancers, affects adepts. Like, they're perhaps someone like Dulcinea, her necromancy would be able to help extend her life, but like, she still has sickle cell anemia. And it's still, I think it still maps pretty good.
It can come with complications that involve things like extreme pain and exhaustion and coughing up blood. And so a lot of Dulcinea's symptoms could possibly map onto sickle cell.
That's really interesting.
Or Kithareas, rather. Dulcinea has like a totally different thing going on.
Okay, you think it's because I would be curious if the one were to apply the idea that it was the same thing.
I guess I was thinking that they had something different because they use different medical aids. Kithareia is described as having crutches, I think. And Dulcinea, the real Dulcinea, has like a tube.
Real
But that
Dulcie
doesn't mean that they.
Real Dulcie is she in the next book or at the end of this book?
She's in the next book.
She's in the next book. Okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah. But it's mentioned, I think, in this book. I think in this book, Protesilaus developed a tube using sort of necromantic technology for her to use. And
Okay.
so part of why he clocks Kithareia is because she's not using it.
Right. Protesilaus developed the like necromantic technology for
Wait, did I say Protesilaus?
it.
Great. Let me try that again. Palamedes.
Palamedes, yeah, developed the.
Palamedes developed this technology for this necromantic tube, but it's not exactly clear, I think, what the tube is for, whether this is like a breathing apparatus or it could be like a gastric tube of some kind. But he developed this tube for her to use. And part of the reason that he knows that Kithareia is not actually Dulcinea is because she doesn't actually present correctly, which it seems like Dulcie kind of like did a bit of cleverness in being interviewed by Kithareia before she was going to get murdered, that she knew that Kithareia was going to take her place. And so she kind of like left some breadcrumbs.
Oh, I like her even more now.
Yeah, she's great.
The idea that she's like leaving little puzzles behind for Palamedes is like tragic and sweet.
That's how I read it.
I like that read. I like that read. That fits them. Knowing that, she may have left these breadcrumbs for Palamedes, knowing that they had this correspondence for all these years, like it starts to paint the silhouette of someone. And someone who probably would have been good friends with Harrowhark as well, because they all appreciate detailed subtlety. Kithareia is not wanting to use detailed subtlety because she has to make a splash and start her plan in action right away. She doesn't have time to use detailed subtlety. But knowing that Palamedes understands this trait of Dulcinea's, she could even, so she might like hide the idea about this necromantic tube. She might also plant the idea for Kithareia that her mannerisms are more extreme. Like, these are all things that are subtle, but that Palamedes, because I like, they're these very detail, high detail oriented minds, right? And my head's always like, well, Palamedes and Harrowhark and Dulcinea would all be lovely friends, and they would like sit and like talk about really nerdy shit together.
I feel like Dulcinea and Gideon would also get along like a house on fire.
Yeah, I feel like Dulcinea has a sense of humor.
Dulcinea has a brashness that I feel like Gideon would really vibe with. Like, I could absolutely see Harrow and Palamedes and Dulcinea having a rad time together, but I could equally see a very different time being had by Dulcinea and Gideon and Cam.
Yeah, totally.
Get you a necromancer who can do both.
Talking about what teacher may or may not know, something like melancholy and something like resignation. How much autonomous thought does teacher have? Like what capacity to feel melancholy and resignation does he have as a construct?
It seems like he has pretty rich emotions, thinking about, like, he is genuinely deeply afraid of the facility.
Yes.
In the river bubble, he has a lot of very intense feelings as well. So it does seem like he has an emotional richness and a capacity to form independent judgments and to respond situationally beyond, he's not just kind of programmed. But yeah, these moments, as you point out, I'm reminded of the moment that we looked into where Gideon couldn't quite make sense of Iglamine's expression. These moments where Gideon can't parse what an adult is feeling really points to these instances of, narrative irony where somebody knows something that Gideon just doesn't know.
Yeah, totally. And maybe this is a thing to start watching for. These are our flags that Muir is providing us multiple layers in this particular section. Someone is here to say you don't see everything, but someone is here that does.
We close out this chapter with Gideon feeling absolutely tragic about the idea of Dulcinea dying at age 25, which she did do.
So I saw a live performance last night, and one of them was talking about like a particularly like poignant disappointment, and it was kind of framed to lead up to this heartache of like, you know, there was going to be this magical thing happening, and then plan shifted and it wasn't able to happen. And the punchline to the performer telling the story leading into the song was, you know, and I was so sad because I was really horny. And my brain like Gideon remembered a coy wink and felt terribly sad because she was really horny.
He was really already.
It's pretty believable, but like it's nice to think that someone is being sad for Dulcinea so soon after her demise.
Yeah.
Whether they meant it to be quite like that or not, the thought is technically there. We have one more little crumb here that I noticed at the very end. 25 years and Herr Hark was probably going to live forever. Herr does ascend to lictorship. So, you know, we can now say we have a pretty solid chance of being that not only is Mir leaving us these breadcrumbs of things that are going to happen within the book, of jokes that have happened outside the book's universe, but also things that are a bit of a checkoff. Here's my painful predictable number one. This is also going to come back in Alecto for some reason, this line. This line is going to be used to hurt our feelings again.
Nunpod with Left Grief is created by Claire Beans and Han Kaylee and edited by Han Kaylee. Our music is Only Human by Philip Ayers. Today's cover art is by Ninth Night Cosplay. Visit us at nunpod.com. That's NUNPOD.com. Thanks for listening.